Today, we're all going to learn a new term. It's only two words. Now listen closely. Can all of you say constructive fraud?
Constructive fraud!
Did you ever get the feeling, as you're staring at the ceiling, that this game of life we play ain't fair? Seems as fast as we can make it, there's a hand that grabs and takes it till they find us in a grave somewhere. Like a rodent on a treadmill, we keep pushing for it uphill, but we never seem to get too far. Well, if you think you're being taken, then you're ready to awaken to the truth of what we really are. We're all indentured servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered feudal knaves, who have lost our soul posterity through ignorance and apathy, and now we're being taxed out of our graves. And as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb, contented with some socialistic crumb. Well, the naked truth and fact is we're all saps who pay our taxes, and that is why the banksters keep us dumb. Could the state of our condition be the product of omission, what we didn't learn in public schools? And did our fathers all through history all fight and die for liberty so we could play the tyrant's fools? And can you call it education when it's all indoctrination to obey the hidden powers that be? Did we fight the revolution? Did we win the world wars just to slumber into slavery? We're all indentured servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered feudal knaves, who have lost our soul posterity through ignorance and apathy. And now we're being taxed out of our graves. And as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb, contented with some humanistic crumb. Well, the naked truth and fact is we're all saps who pay those taxes, and that is why the banksters keep us dumb. While Franklin and Eleanor were telling us they hated war, they made a deal behind our backs. They said the bankers could enslave us for a portion of our wages, and today we call it income tax. But what they failed them to tell us was the way they planned to sell us into statutory slavery. Now it's called constructive fraud. Some even claim the wrath of God. I call it social insecurity. Let's stop being indentured servitudal slaves, overburdened and bewildered feudal knaves, and reclaim our lost posterity. Rise up and proclaim liberty. It's high time we rock the boat and make some waves, 'cause as long as we stay passive, we'll succumb. They'll start us on their communistic crumb. And the naked truth and fact is we don't have to pay those taxes. Yes, it's time we show those banksters, those international gangsters. So let's turn the tables and spoil all their fun.
That's all.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker in north central Indiana on a Saturn's Day. Yeah, we're on the day all those Orthodox Jews go to church, and some of those Orthodox Christian fundamentalists go too. Isn't that interesting? What is it, the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Seventh-day Adventists go to church on Saturn's Day? How about that? Well, it's still some snow on the ground here. It's going to be a while before that melts. It's got down to, I think I said 6 degrees last night. Or was it 6 below? I lose track, man. Yeah. But it's a sunshiny day, a nice day, and I haven't seen any more robins, so I don't know what's going on there about springtime coming and all that stuff. So we'll just go on with the politics of race and money and environment and things like that. I would like to announce that that number we had, a national number of 559-670-1413, is no good no more. I took that down. But we still got a freebie line. That's 641-715-3800. But you have to put in the code, which is 56890*. And you can leave all the messages you want on that line. It's 641-715-3800. Press 56890*. There you go. Well, I see they may shut down Homeland Security. We didn't need it in the first place. They say 30,000 people will get layoff notices. Tell me, consider the payroll and the overhead of Homeland Security and the fact that it's handed out multi-millions to private contractors who've taken us for a ride on all kinds of expensive crap we don't need, and tell me why we need Homeland Security. Homeland Security hasn't protected me one iota. In fact, if anything, it's tried to get me. So I hope they don't. They just disband Homeland Security. And, of course, you know why they call it Homeland, because all kinds of political power brokers like to use nice, cozy, comfortable words like that. You know, like national defense instead of war. Yeah. Get it? Well, I see they pulled another boner, probably at the request of the U.S. military-industrial complex in Egypt, to outlaw Hamas as a terrorist party, while the Hamas is the only recognized, democratically elected group in Gaza and Palestine. And so that's going to complicate things, and that'll probably re-fire up. The more they pressure Hamas in Egypt, the more the chance of Hamas or the Palestinians rising up again in Israel. So don't make much sense. Perhaps even behind the scenes, the Mossad in Israel has stoked this thing so that they can get these Palestinians fired up again and causing Israel trouble, and then Israel's got another excuse. And of course, they try to couple all this to Iran. You know, we got to get Iran, we got to get Iran, when actually we were the ones who destabilized Iran in the first place, the U.S. government, back in the 50s, when we caused the overthrow of a Melzadek, the democratically elected president of Iran. And ever since that, we've been, ever since they overthrew the Shah, the dictator Shah, there's been problems. And of course, Israel goes day and night, get Iran, get Iran. We should put some gorilla tape over Nitwit's mouth. Netanyahu, he talks about fascists and Nazis. If there ever was an aggressive son of a bitch, it's Nitwit, or Netanyahu as he's called. And when he speaks before Congress, if you're home, watch it, because you're going to see every lapdog in the Congress. Every time he makes a point, even a non-point, every time he farts or chuckles, they're going to be on their feet saluting him like, you know what? Like they don't even salute the president. I don't mean just this president. I mean any president. But when it comes to Israel, they're all kissing ass 24/7. yesterday I talked about that garden plot put together by Ronald Reagan and Ed Meese in California, and they tried it out on the Indians at Wounded Knee. And I said who the leader, I didn't know who the leader was, I forgot. It was Russell Means that Pastor Bob Miles, when he was doing 10 years in federal prison, got to talk to Russell Means quite a bit. That was a real set-up deal up there in Wounded Knee against the Indians. And, of course, the feds picked it up and used it against people like Randy Weaver and all these other outlaw actions by the federal government against common people. You know, the sharpshooter killings in the trial that just ended out there in Texas. Now, what were these guys thinking of that took this guy who was obviously damaged goods to the shooting range? Now, why would you be so stupid as to risk taking a mentally screwed up PTS or you know, radiation affected soldier that's had all kinds of problems and imagination things and everything else, imagining things, taking to the gun range? Sounds to me like the two guys that were killed were a lot stupider than what is let on that they were. They're supposed to be real sharp and smart people. That would be like if I knew a guy here in town that had a meth addiction and imagined people after him and everything else, and I'd take him out to the gun range and give him a gun. The guy should have beat the charge. There's no doubt about that. He should have beat the charge just based on things like that. Would you take a guy out in the field with who thinks he's Napoleon and take the chance that he might not ride his horse over the top of you? I don't think so. Don't let the corporations mess your mind up. Net neutrality is a great thing, and it's one good thing that's came along in a long time, that the Federal Communications has done something right, and that's will enforce net neutrality. In other words, keep it free. Let's listen to a little bit about that.
Hello, my name is Mitchell Baker, and I'm the Executive Chairwoman of the Mozilla Foundation. We work to create opportunity and openness online and to build an internet that has the opportunity for all of us. Today, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission issued net neutrality rules that are strong under what is known as Title II, and this is an enormous step forward in helping us all protect the openness and innovation that has made online life and the internet so remarkable to date. This occurred because millions of people, including hundreds of thousands of self-identified Mozillians, joined together to demand strong protection for an open internet. And so today I want to thank you, everyone who took action, everyone who supported net neutrality, and everyone who took steps to help promote, preserve, and build a stronger open internet. Thank you.
Yeah, Comcast and the big boys and all of them thought they could walk over people, but the people got together from the left and the right and the middle and on top and everything else and fought this thing and won to keep the internet free of domination by the corporations. You know, from now on, I'm going to refer to these so-called conservatives because they're not conserving anything. A real conservative is very rare. So I call them corporatist. The conservative thing has turned into the corporatist. So from now on, I'll refer to them as corporatists, not conservatives. Well, let's tune in to see what the hell's going on in the money market with old Kaiser, our good buddy Kaiser. How about that? Come on, Max.
Welcome to the Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. Ernest Hemingway wrote, "The first panacea for a mismanaged nation is inflation of the currency. The second is war. Both bring a temporary prosperity. Both bring permanent ruin. But both are the refuge of political and economic opportunists." And oh, what a refuge our global economy has become for all the makers of political and economic opportunism.
Well, yes, there's so many opportunists out there that I reckon we're looking to look at currencies, because I noticed that central banks have bought 477 tons in 2014. So,
of course.
Of gold.
Oh, gold,
of
yes.
Of course. But that's the only real money in the world.
It might have been chocolate or lithium. You know, lithium is awfully popular now that the world's having a nervous breakdown.
Well, exactly. So they have 477 tons of gold. This is, you know, over the past 50 years, basically, they've been just hoarding their gold. Now they're buying it back. They're buying gold. And, of course, they will know what is what sort of mismanagement and opportunists in their government.
They're remassifying.
They're
remassifying. Remassifying. Yeah, massify. I saw this on my word of the day from my email, word of the day, massify.
Uh-huh.
You take the mass, you're creating a mass, you're remassifying. It sounds like something from a family mass. You say, yo, we all be remassifying. You know, it sounds ghetto. I like that.
Well, in the Ukraine, I noticed that their currency is collapsing. Now, normally the BBC and their flagship show Newsnight is very interested in currency crises. They have been covering nonstop the Russian ruble, but for some reason they have not covered this. The currency was down over 70% now, and you could look at this chart. It's pretty dramatic. And their minimum wage now, because of the currency collapse, is the equivalent of $42.90 per month. So, of course, they would be very happy to join the Eurozone because they could then increase that to 1,000, say. But I'm going to look at another place, what could be in the future for all of us, and that is Zimbabwe. Now, we all have made fun of the Zimbabwe currency. They hit 500% inflation in 2008, 2009. In 2009, they went off their own currency and onto the U.S. dollar, the South African rand. They accept any currency there, in fact. Well, greenback is king, as Zimbabweans favor candy over bond coins. When any more Wakamira was given coins and change at a supermarket in Harare's affluent Barrowdale supermarket, he demanded a handful of candy instead. Like most Zimbabweans, the cement seller has bad memories of the collapse of the country's dollar and surge in inflation to a level the International Monetary Fund estimated at 500% in 2008. The government abolished the national currency in 2009 and allowed the use of foreign exchange, including U.S. dollars and South African rand, from 2009. But over the last few months, it's reintroduced locally minted coins, and it hasn't worked. These new coins are called bond coins.
Right. Well, these new bond coins are backed by nothing.
Yes.
They like the dollar because the dollar is backed by oil and war. We'll get on to John Kerry in a second. The candy that's used as a currency is backed by one of the other most heavily traded commodities in the world, and that would be sugar.
Mm.
You know, sugar is a trade commodity since, 500 years ago. It became the first era of globalization after Columbus, of course, was based on sugar, slavery, booze. That was a key commodity, and it transformed this country, Britain, from a nation of healthy people to a nation of obese, rotted teeth, monarch-driven louts. I'll say that. But, you know, Kerry, you mentioned Kerry, I didn't mention, the BBC didn't cover the crash of the Ukrainian currency like they did the ruble, which was down a few weeks ago. And John Kerry came out recently and said that, oh, RT is broadcasting in English and I can't compete with that. The reason that RT is succeeding is not because they broadcast in English, John, it's because they actually cover the news, unlike the BBC, which selectively covers only stories that support their propaganda and war. So that's the difference, John. BBC and American TV are propaganda. RT is what you might have never seen in your lifetime, except when you were fighting for the Vietnam War during a brief period of honesty, journalism.
So let's go back to the story in Zimbabwe. So here is this guy. They receive these new bond coins, and the bond coins are in order to alleviate the shortage of U.S. coins because they have dollars and up. So they don't have any coins, and they keep on handing out this candy. But this guy, Anymore, is his name. He's 36. He remains resolute. His small roadside supply business, which sells mainly cement, sand, and stone, won't be accepting or giving fake James Bond money, he said. That stuff is for fools, he said. Imagine they suddenly decide all money will be bond money. We're back to square one. There's only one currency in this whole world, and that is the U.S. dollar. It works anywhere, and it works here. And as you're saying, most U.S. actual hard currency is outside of the United States. It's around the world in places like this. It's in Mexico with for all the drug laundering and the money exchange like that. But It's a one where the one nation which has legitimate war, like any war they're involved in is legitimate according to the world. So it's always backed by that. Of course, Zimbabwe has no oil, so they haven't been bombed while they mismanage their economy.
Well, the U.S. dollar has currency because after World War II, it became the world reserve currency. It was backed up by gold. Then in the 70s, it became backed up by oil. And you can't buy any commodity in the world, including sugar, unless you first buy dollars, because commodities are traded in dollars. Oil is traded in dollars. When Japan needs to buy oil, they have to first buy dollars. So the seigniorage on this, the gift, the money that is just pumped into the U.S. economy based on this monopoly position is huge. And Zimbabweans currently favor the U.S. dollar, but that reign of the dollar is kind of in the end game. So they'll be switching over to something else like Bitcoin soon enough.
Well, of course, in the fiat currency system world, he mentions fools, and you always have to rely on a greater fool to buy your property that you want to flip, to buy your shares that you want to flip at the all-time high, the bonds you want to flip at an all-time high. And there's no greater fool in the fiat world than Alan Greenspan. But he says, last month, he said this at the Council for Foreign Relations, he said, gold is a currency. It is still, by all evidence, a premier currency. No fiat currency, including the dollar, can match it. So in terms of anymore, this guy in Zimbabwe, what he should really say is that gold, which Zimbabwe has quite a lot of it, you know, is actually the premier currency, according to Alan Greenspan. And, of course, he would know what sort of opportunists are behind the scenes on the central bank level and sees that the central banks are now buying 477 tons of gold, and the World Gold Council expects it's going to be the same near to that this year.
Yeah, well, Greenspan is experiencing reverse senility. So he was senile as Fed chairman when he talked about irrational exuberance and did nothing back in the 90s. Since he's been left the chair of Federal Reserve Bank in Washington, he has come out and said things like all the pretext and all the premise that he guided him for his policies on monetary policies throughout his career was flawed. It was based on some assumptions that proved to be completely erroneous. And he had a moment of clarity. And he said, you know what? My entire career is nonsense. So he has reverse senility. The older he gets, it seems like the clearer he becomes.
Well, in his early career, he talked about gold all the time. That was his area of expertise. Now, I want to look at this chart here that Zero Hedge had posted in regards to inequality. Zero Hedge points out here, this blue line is the bottom 90% of earners in terms of their income growth. The red line is the top 1%. Now, they note that in August 1971, Nixon ended the U.S. gold standard, and you see soon after that, the top 1% took off. But they didn't notice this whole early bit. So this is from pre-1920 to 1934-35, right after the U.S. went off the domestic gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, here everybody was equal. Their incomes went up together and down together. And then right after the U.S. went off the gold standard for domestic purposes and stayed on it internationally, the bottom 90% of earners took off from the top 1%. And it seems to me that that's a sign that when you had to trade real goods and services because there was a real global currency, which is gold, you actually had to reward the wealth creators. This is the true wealth creators were the bottom 90%, the workers, the builders, the constructors. Here, once we're in a fiat world, that anymore Wakamira in Zimbabwe recognizes we're in, where he talks about made-up currencies. Made-up currency favors the top 1%.
Yeah, well, this is, if you see here in 1980, you see this explosion of this group, and that's based on the creation of derivatives due to deregulation under the Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan era.
And so, it's a device for fraud to steal wealth.
Yes, yeah, so you can sell the same bond.
Yes.
An infinite number of times.
You create bond coin.
Yeah, you can create a bond and you can sell it 1,000 times, 100,000 times. You get a fee every single time. And then to square the circle, they put all the excess garbage bonds onto the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve Bank, which became extremely overloaded with these fake bonds. It has a 100-to-1 debt-to-equity ratio. So they've got the European Central Bank. This is part of what's happening in Europe, and the conflict between Germany and Greece is that Germany wants to load up with 100 trillion euros worth of fake bonds as a way to keep the zombie banks afloat. And they want to go through this. Germany wants to have this. As a matter of fact, the German stock market just hit a new all-time high based on their ability to create this nonsensical chart of fake money.
The other thing backing a currency, of course, is taxes. And with all of that fraud that has happened since 1980, unchecked fraud and the opportunists committing that fraud in the various banks, here's a headline from the United Kingdom. Emma Thompson and Greg Weiss in tax boycott over HSBC scandal. Well, they put Emma Thompson first, but it was actually her husband, Greg Weiss, who said this and spoke on her behalf. But he said, "I want to stop paying tax until everyone pays tax. I am disgusted with HMRC, Her Majesty's Revenues and Customs. I am disgusted with HSBC, and I'm not paying a penny more until these evil go to prison. Em's on board. She's agreed. We're going to get a load of us together, a movement. They can't send everyone to prison, but we'll go to prison if necessary. I mean it. It's going to be like 1848 all over again."
1848. This, of course, is civil disobedience, and this is what's needed for a revolution. You know, you have two choices, either violent overthrow, as the French Revolution is a good example, or a nonviolent overthrow, like Gandhi is a good example. So those are your two choices. By civil disobedience of this type, don't pay tax, or don't pay your license fee is my favorite. You know, the BBC has been caught in so much corruption in the last 12 months. You know, the fact that you're paying a license fee is absurd. I think en masse the entire country should stop.
But the point is that the licensee payer is now rising up against the tax, which is the smallest bit of the fraud of the crimes that have been committed by HSBC since 1980. We've talked about the drug money laundering. We've talked about the market rigging of Forex markets, LIBOR rigging, gold market rigging. They're involved in all of that stuff. And this is the puniest thing that has triggered them off. The Bank of England now here in the United Kingdom, they're also looking at Bitcoin. And one of the reasons why they're looking at Bitcoin, they say, is because it could reduce costs of transmission of remittances. And so they want to create their own coin to do this and replace it.
Yeah, right. A little too late, Mark Carney, blowhard. All right, Stacey, you've got to go. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Max and Stacey. Good report. I like that sound of revolution. Well, let's get back into our man called Lucy. The man who set up the spy ring within the chancellery of the Third Reich that led to the total failure of Barbarossa, the attack on Russia, through his spying activities, in which 10 high-ranking officers of the Third Reich with access to the telex and so forth in the chancellery were able to, right under the noses of National Socialist Security agents, Gestapo and everybody else, transmit fresh battle plans and so forth directly to Rösler by radio in Switzerland, and then he would give it to the Russians. I said before I thought he was Jewish, but I'm not sure about that. I think it said he had... The family was Protestant or something, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. But anyhow. Okay, here we go. Chapter 3. Switzerland, a population of under 5 million and an area of 15,944 miles, one quarter of it in uninhabitable rock and ice, a calm, reserved, hard-working people, rearing the finest cows in the world and producing probably its best Gruyere cheese and finest watches. Well, the watch thing is passed by. But their most precious asset was their neutrality, not just any kind of neutrality. Well, after reading a lot of books, you'll find out that they weren't that neutral. The Journal de Geneva for Wednesday, August 30th, 1939, claimed that the involuntary neutrality of Belgium and the independent neutrality of Holland were not juridically the same thing as the Confederation's total neutrality, Switzerland being more neutral than the other neutral countries. They weren't quite neutral enough, so the German army marched right through them. Switzerland believed that she had secretly done everything possible to keep herself outside the bonfire that Hitler was preparing for Europe. At the end of August 1939, she appeared in her most traditional role. A week before the war's outbreak, two symbolic events occurred, events which Switzerland was delighted to identify and which occupied the front pages of her newspapers. On Monday, August the 21st, the 33rd World Peace Conference was solemnly opened in Zurich. All over Europe, except Germany, Italy, and Spain, were represented. The next day, International Red Cross, that owed so much to Switzerland, celebrated its 75th anniversary in Geneva. In this stormy, rainy holiday month at Basel, the firemen were called out 700 times on Monday, the 21st, to pump out flooded cellars. All the hotels were full. Never had there been so many British and French tourists. The national exhibition in Zurich was enjoying an immense success. On Sunday, August 20th, the 7 millionth visitor passed through the turnstiles. Everything helped to hide the specter of the feast. Two movie houses, however, offered programs that reflected the ongoing drama. In Geneva, the Cinebref announced Danzig, the only newsreel taken in the free city. And in Lausanne, the Modern Cinema was presenting a documentary on the Maginot Line, the most amazing defensive creation of modern times. But box office receipts were far greater at the Rex, with the Ferdinando Raphael La Tatu, and at the ABC with Remu in Monsieur Bretonneau. However, on Thursday, August 24, 1939, the Federal Council took a secret census of Swiss industry, an action of the greatest importance, since it was intended to provide the essential basis for Switzerland's commercial policy, particularly for its war economy. The same day, just as secretly, the Swiss Postal Department, with the agreement of the federal police, seized hundreds of letters intended for Germany. They contained anti-Nazi propaganda of British origin. On the eve of the war, the Confederation could not afford to give Hitler the slightest pretext to question Swiss neutrality. An indication that the war was not far off occurred the following day. Friday, August 25th, the United Kingdom's ambassador in Bern warned all British subjects wishing to leave Switzerland to do so the same night, since it appeared that the normal services of the international railways were about to be suspended. The next day, August 26th, the Federal Council held an extraordinary meeting in Bern. The German minister there had just confirmed that the Reich would respect Switzerland's neutrality in the event of war. Giuseppe Motta, head of the political department, emphasized that this in no way released Switzerland from her own obligation to take all necessary measures to ensure her neutrality be preserved. It was no more than the other neutrals, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, had done after receiving similar assurances from Germany. Herr Minger, head of the military department, insisted on the fact that Switzerland must be ready to defend her frontiers at the first sign of danger. All of the federal counselors were therefore requested to remain in Bern so that they might be consulted immediately in any emergency. They did not have to wait long. At 3 p.m. on Monday, August 28th, the counselors filed once more into the federal palace. At the same time, a significant event took place in Chiasso, a town on the Italian frontier near Lake Como. 62 Polish Jews who had come to attend the Zionist conference in Geneva were on their way home via Italy, thus avoiding Austria or Germany. Insulted and stoned by Italian fascists, they stood huddled together in the Chiasso customs office, waiting the return of their representative who had gone to ask for help of the Swiss authorities of the canton of Ticino. At 5 a.m. the next day, Switzerland mobilized its frontier troops. By press and radio, Herr Philipp Etter, the president of the Confederation, instructed all men who had a red form in their army books to go directly to the assigned meeting places. He asked the rest of the population to keep calm. Do not panic. I would particularly ask you to refrain from spreading false rumors, from making unnecessary food purchases, and from sudden withdrawals of money from the banks. All steps have been taken to guarantee adequate food supplies and free circulation of money. Tomorrow, Wednesday, August the 30th, at 5 p.m., the Federal Assembly will elect a general. I repeat, all necessary steps have been taken. What stuck in the minds of most of the President's listeners were the words, "The Federal Assembly will elect a general." This was sure proof that war was imminent, for the Swiss Army possessed no general in peacetime, and each soldier keeps his rifle, ammunition, and other equipment at home. According to Article 89, Chapter 3 of the Constitution, the Assembly entrusts the command of this army to an officer elected for the purpose only when the Confederation's neutrality is threatened. There had been General Guillaume Dufour in 1859 at the time of the war between Italy and Austria, General Herzog in 1870, General Ulrich Weil in 1914. The fourth Swiss general was to be Henry Gesine. Switzerland had been expecting the outbreak of war for so long that Colonel Gesine had known for some months that he would be offered the post. On Wednesday, August 30th, Gesine, a very young-looking 65, was duly elected general by 204 votes against 21 for his opponent, Colonel Borel. There were two abstentions, those of the communist counselors Bodman and Humpert. Gesine took the oath of allegiance to the Confederation, swearing to defend, with the troops under his command, the honor and independence and neutrality of his country. It was the same oath that Ulrich Weil took while in 1914. There was a resemblance between the two men's ends. Weil was an extremely cautious man, whereas Gesine did not hesitate to gamble if he considered that it was for his country's good. Under Weil, Switzerland had been pro-German. In 1939, under Gesine's guidance, Switzerland was to play, at best, it could, the Allies' game. Weil was cold and forbidding. Henry Gesine was to become the most popular citizen in the Confederation. The day before the general mobilization, Giuseppe Matta, head of the political department, had received in turn representatives of the future belligerents. They all assured him that the Confederation's territory neutrality would be respected. Signor Tamaro, the Italian ambassador, had even told him that Italy's transalpine ports and roads would be open for Swiss traffic. All that was needed was for the two governments to settle the details of such agreement. Matta thanked the ambassador for what seemed to be a very generous offer, but secretly it gave him no pleasure at all. It could not be as simple as Signor Tamaro made out. With Switzerland was entering a time of compromise, of overt commitments and secret agreements. On Saturday, September 2, the day of the mobilization, armored trucks toured the Swiss banks. Their safes were emptied and the contents taken to a virtual Alibaba's cave in the middle of the Alps. Switzerland was quick to protect one of its chief assets, the fortunes of others. At dawn that same Saturday, 400,000 men took up their positions around the country's frontiers. On the orders of the federal consul, Henry Gesine had to set up his headquarters in the Bellevue Hotel in Bern to be the nearest the federal palace. It was there, on the third floor, that General Weil had housed his headquarters in 1914. Weil may have felt at home there. Certainly, Gesine did not. He insisted on moving. He went first to Spitz, then to Gumligen, and then to Interlaken, and finally to Jürgensdorf. The Swiss upper class, which always tended to be pro-German, was quick to claim that Gesine traveled around far more than was necessary, that too many little girls came to bring him flowers and murmur compliments. that he tended to court popularity to the detriment of his military duties. It was even pointed out that he had totally eclipsed the president of the Confederation in the people's affections. One thing I want to mention here is that the upper classes tended to be pro-German, which means that they tended to be, in this case, so-called National Socialists, which show how far true National Socialism had slipped. Because when the upper classes, which were scared to death of true National Socialism because of its leveling process economically and so forth, and protection of the workers, would tend to be different, you see. So that gives you an idea which way National Socialism had drifted. It was even pointed out he had totally eclipsed the president of the Confederation in the people's affections, but it was not to the office, but to the man that Swiss were driven. The Swiss felt vaguely that Guzan was doing more for defense of their country than any of his predecessors, and that they were safe in his hands, but Guzan did not always stop to receive the crowd's acclamations. His time was severely limited, for contrary to what some believed, he never stopped working on behalf of the army and slept no more than 5 hours a night. When he took charge of Switzerland's defense, Guzan commanded a terribly vulnerable army, which he said to have remarked could not have held out longer than a week against an attack. 400,000 men guarding the country against the Third Reich. 600 rounds of ammunition per man and 44 anti-aircraft guns, 835 anti-tank guns, 121 reconnaissance planes, and 86 fighters, most of them obsolete. He resolved to change all that. He would entrench the Swiss army in fortresses dug out of the Alps and block the mountain passes and tunnels. Stocks of food and ammunition would be organized. He was determined to build up an army that could stave off an aggressor for 2 years. This would act, if not a guarantee, at least as a front to his country's often quoted total neutrality. This reminds me of back in the 60s, way back, just after I'd moved to Fallbrook, California. We were hot right-wingers at the time, and the John Birch Society and all that, and we were contemplating if someone was coming in to take over Fallbrook in some kind of hostilities or invasion or government operation or something. And we determined there were only two ways in, or one way in, one way out, or two ways into Fallbrook. One was an old concrete bridge, very beautiful bridge, actually. And the other was the road, a two-lane road that went out the other way and ended up on the interstate. We had it all figured out how we would first blow up those two things to keep the aggressor out of the town, I mean, at least temporarily. So that's how serious the right wing was back in those days, along with the Minutemen, the John Birch Society, and everybody else, of pending occupation from who knows who, whether it would be a rotten federal government or a communist invasion or whatever. So that's how hot it was back at the time, and there were tons of ammunition and arms buried all over the desert and up north and out in the desert, I guess San Bernardino and up that way. I do know that was going on, and in later years they kept finding that stuff. A hiker would be going along a trail and the water had washed out cases of grenades and everything else, and that was back in the days when the right wing were really serious. Anyhow, secretly Henry Guzan carried his plans much further. He was well aware that the German emigre of exceptional value had settled in Lucerne and had offered his services to Major Hans Hausmann's bureau, HA, in which he took a particular interest. Guzan felt that before long such collaboration might present very serious problems of conscience, but he decided, at least temporarily, to ignore them and stifle his scruples for him, too, it was absolutely vital that Nazi Germany would lose the war. Chapter 4. Most espionage cases are based upon a single, often quite crucial, but nonetheless isolated event of short duration. The masterstroke of Richard Sorge, for example, was the acquisition of intelligence proving Japan would not attack the Soviet Union. It enabled Stalin to leave Siberia virtually undefended and throw his best divisions against Hitler without fear of attack from the east. The enormous value of Rudolf Rösler and his 10 collaborators of the Lucy Ring, or Viking Line, as the Swiss named them, was based on a body of intelligence just as sensational as that of Richard Sorge, but which lasted for more than 5 years. The quality of the intelligence communicated by these German resistors to the Alps, quite apart from the information they supplied later to others in even larger quantities, amounts to 12,000 closely typed pages, an equivalent of 40 average length books. Almost every day, Rösler arrived at the Villa Stutz at Katanabaum with a pile of documents in his briefcase. From the time he was engaged with the Swiss military experts, were able, with the information supplied by Werther and Olga, to reconstruct the movements and strategy of the Wehrmacht in the greatest detail. It may not be an overstatement to say that these 11 men, 10 of whom remained unknown to Brigadier Mason, were largely responsible for the reputation of the Swiss Secret Service. Mason had been faced with a serious problem of conscience when he learned that an agent as well informed as Rösler had offered his services to Switzerland. In the wealth of information, Rösler promised it was obvious that very little would be direct concern to Switzerland, a very minor objective for German expansionism. On the other hand, it was just as obvious that Western Europe would be attacked, but Mason could not compromise the Confederation's future by officially warning the diplomatic representatives of these countries whenever he received intelligence concerning them. Yet his sympathy for the Allies obliged him to try to discover some effective means of helping them without involving Switzerland, at least overtly. It was Hans Hausermann who found a temporary solution. One was to last until 1944. Quite by chance, a foreigner said to be the Canadian uncle of Hausermann's wife, and whom they nicknamed Uncle Tom, was at the Villa Stutz when Rösler arrived with intelligence that would be of great service to the Allies. This man, in fact, was Czech, Colonel Thomas Sedlacek, and he volunteered to act as a contact with the Allied governments. Soon after the opening of the Wehrmacht's campaign in Poland, Rösler had become a fairly accomplished wireless operator, having absorbed 3 months the lessons of his friend Christian Schneider. Schneider asked no questions. He claimed to be a communist, and although he did not share Rösler's ideas, he knew that it was not to help the Nazis that he had obtained the transmitter. The first news received by Rösler concerned the Nazi terror in Poland. On September 23, 1939, he arrived at the Villa Stutz, overcome with emotion, bringing with him a copy of a plan that Heydrich had issued to the Army High Command 2 days before. Quote, "The Third Reich will not rebuild Poland. As soon as the conquest has been completed, the aristocracy and the clergy must be exterminated. The people must be kept at a very low standard of living. They will provide cheap slaves. The Jews will be grouped into towns where they will remain easily accessible. The final solution," Heydrich stated, "will take the same time to be worked out and must be kept strictly secret, unquote. Well, the officers of the Wehrmacht and for those Swiss who learned of this message, there could be no doubt as to the meaning of the phrase final solution. It meant extermination. These orders, inspired directly by the Führer, were to be carried out by Hans Frank, who had been appointed Governor General of Poland. It is a difficult matter, he was later to admit, to shoot or poison 3.5 million Polish Jews, but we will be able to take the necessary steps to bring about their annihilation, unquote. Frank's words were to prove true enough. Colonel Sedlik was at the Villa Stutz when Rosser sent the news that the Wehrmacht was preparing to attack Holland, Belgium, northeastern France. It was October 13, 1939. 3 days later, Hitler had called a meeting of his generals. He was furious because Halder and Brashnisch had declared that it would take several months to repair the damage done to the tank units by the Polish campaign. The Führer had raged, banging his fist on his desk in the chancellery. Time is on the enemy's side, he was reported to have roared. Preparations must be speeded up for an offensive through Luxembourg, Belgium, and Holland. We must do the worst possible damage to the French army and gain as much ground as possible. I am asking the commanders in chief to supply me with the detailed reports of their plans immediately. A war of position, as in 1914 and 18, must be avoided. The armored divisions will be used for crucial thrusts. The attack on Holland and Belgium will take place on November 12th. Uncle Tom went at once to inform the British embassy. The Dutch and the Belgians were also warned. On November 7th, Rosler announced that the offensive had been postponed. The conflict between Hitler and his generals had not been resolved. During the autumn and winter of 1939 and 40, there were to be 14 such decisions and postponements. Each time, Rudolf Rosler contacted the Swiss and the Allies were informed. On November 23, 1939, the Führer again summoned his generals to the Chancellery. This time, in addition to the offensive to the west, with which he was principally concerned, Hitler mentioned the possibility of a war on two fronts, a nightmare for any military leader. For the first time, he spoke of an attack on Russia. Despite the treaty binding Germany to the Soviet Union to justify expansion into the Second Front, he attributed his own motives to the Soviet Union, discussing his personal objectives. Treaties, he declared, are respected as long as they serve a particular interest. Russia will respect ours only as long as she considers it to her advantage. She still has very far-reaching aims, notably the strengthening of her position in the Baltic. The moment seems to be a judicious one. This new intelligence from Rosler deeply disturbed the Swiss, helping the Western Allies fighter their dignity, their instinctive solidarity with a world like their own. But this was another case entirely. Despite their previous hospitality to a few of the Russian revolutionary leaders, they distrusted the communist regime. Worse still, the Soviet Union was not yet at war with Nazi Germany. She could even be regarded as her accomplice, since the gasoline used by the Wehrmacht in Poland came from Baku and the corn consumed by these same German soldiers came from the Ukraine. To offer help to the Russians would constitute betrayal. After some reflection, the Swiss decided to postpone any decision, so the Bureau, HA, simply tabled Rosler's message, and Rosler went along with them. At this stage, he was still full of confidence, but not realizing that the West would take no action of exceptional value of his information. The flood of communications followed. Wirthe and Olga omitted none of the Führer's plans from their application by the OKW. In January 1940 and throughout February, as Hitler moved on to the preparations for the invasion of Norway, the Bureau HA was kept informed. From February 26 onward, Mason's men had complete details of the coming invasion. So you see what's happening here? There isn't anything they were doing at the Chancellery and among the German High Command that was not passed on to the so-called Allies. On March 1st, Hitler addressed a directive to his generals concerning the future occupation of Denmark, an operation that was to be linked to General Nicholas von Falkenhorst's invasion of Norway. Both operations claimed Hitler would prevent Britain's getting a foothold in Scandinavia and the Baltic. They would also guarantee Sweden's ore resources, which had been put at Germany's disposal. On March 8th, the Bureau HA received the main context of this directive. Well before the Wehrmacht could put their plans against Scandinavia into practice, Denmark and Norway had been alerted by the Swiss. Nonetheless, both countries were surprised. On the evening of April 8th, the King of Denmark went to the Royal Theater despite his knowledge that a German troopship had been torpedoed by a Polish submarine south of Norway and that a fleet of Kriegsmarine was making for its ports. That day, the Norwegian cabinet, too, seemed strangely inactive, even after several ships had been sighted moving towards the coast. On March 30, 1940, and again on April 3, 1940, Colonel G.J. Sass, Dutch military attaché in Berlin, was warned by the Swiss military attaché of the fate awaiting Denmark. Curiously enough, Colonel Hans Oster, an adjutant of Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, remember, Canaris turned out to be a double agent who was working for the West, and was executed in 44, I believe it was. The head of the Abwehr, that's why German intelligence got hardly anything done in the United States. I mean, you'd have thought they would have had well-planted agents for years and years, but they had hardly anything. I mean, you know, you're going to declare on a war on a country, you got to have it riddled with intelligence agents. Anyhow, the counterintelligence department of the OKW, who was on the side close personal terms with SAS, also warned him of the danger. SAS SAS immediately informed Captain Jolson, the Danish naval attaché, but the Danish government failed to act, even though the information was confirmed by two sources. See, this is one of the problems that this Roessler had. He was given hot information right off the planning table of the high command, and people either didn't believe it or didn't follow through on it. And we'll get into that later, of how the Russians were so blindsided because they suspected him of being a German agent. On March 25, 1940, on the basis of information from the Bureau, HA, the Norwegian government was also alerted to the threat of invasion through its legation in Bern. The Swiss agent emphasized the extreme reliability of the intelligence, but to no avail. He, too, was completely ignored. Again, another source, this time the Swedish military attaché in Berlin, confirmed the news on April 5th in vain. The German plan, Wasserbund, succeeded perfectly without any interference. This tragic episode was typical of the curious attitude of the European high commands and the democratic governments of the period. I guess they just stuck their head in the sand. Unaccustomed to the participation of intelligence services in the conduct of battles, they reacted with instinctive mistrust. Neither Belgium, Holland, nor France was to escape disaster. Like Denmark and Norway, they were given ample warning from secret agents but refused to listen. Astonished, but in no way discouraged by the indecision of the Danish and the Norwegian leaders who had played so well into Hitler's hands, Rudolf Roessler persevered as a flood of alarming intelligence reached him from the Maybach camp in Germany. He had long known that Belgium, the Netherlands, and France were next on the list for attack. The final version of the Yellow Plan was against the West, devised by General Fritz Erich von Manstein, appeared on February 27, 1940. On March 10, 1940, General Delvoye, the Belgian military attaché in Paris, on orders from his government, which had been warned by Roessler's hosts, the Swiss passed the main outlines of the plan on to the French High Command. Von Manstein's Yellow Plan involved an offensive on the Meuse between Charleville and Sedan, and a breakthrough across the Ardennes while the main body of the Wehrmacht was to hold down the mass of French, Belgium, and British forces in the west on the Belgian frontier. The panzers of General Hoth and General Guderian would make the intended attack on the Sedan Gap, then described a gigantic curve in the direction of the lower Somme with the intention of reaching the sea, thus trapping most of the Allied army. General George Thomas had provided for only 3 weeks' supplies of ammunition and fuel. So on March 10, 1940, the French High Command was in possession of full details of the plan. I'll tell you, the more you organize, the more you fuck yourself up. On May 1st, Roessler received a brief message from Werther. Quote, attack 10 May in Sedan Gap. Yellow Plan still holds. 50 divisions massed along the Belgium-Dutch frontiers. Guderian and Hoth ready to charge on Sedan. On the same May 1st, 1940, the French military attaché in Bern, secretly alerted by Colonel Sedlecki, telegraphed at once to Paris, quote, German attack will probably take place on 10 May. It will be directed against Sedan. It was to be hoped that this time the Allied High Commands would not be taken by surprise as those of Denmark and Norway had been, but would be ready for the Wehrmacht with the necessary equipment already in position to confront the oncoming 136 German divisions. This was all the more to be expected, since on the same day Colonel Gauch, head of the Doxium Bureau of the Colonel Rive, head of the Sequim Bureau, never stopped sending to the French government and high command the numerous confirmations they had received from Switzerland on May 4th, 6th, and 8th, among other dates. On May 10th at dawn, the Wehrmacht attacked, and still no one was prepared to defend the point where it made its main thrust. At the, I think Hitler was winning most of the time by default. At the exact location indicated by Werther, and on May 13th, Sedan fell. 3 days later, Guderian's tanks were rolling 62 miles to the west of Sedan across open country, with no opposition in sight. On May 24th, the Allies were encircled. The gigantic curve was complete. The whole operation had been conducted with perfect rigor, for the German land forces were not noted for their powers of improvisation. The three armies, the Belgian, British, and French, endured a terrific bombardment within a small triangle of ground, and only hope of escape for some was by sea from Dunkirk. Now here comes up the probably the first major screw-up by Hitler. I think it had something to do, too, with his astrologist, I remember, or something. If you woke him up, according to information I've read, he used to get all pissed off so people wouldn't want to wake him up, even if the sky was falling. Strategists may argue at leisure about the development of this campaign of 39 and 40, comparing figures and hypothetical tactics, but they will find no valid explanation for this tragic fact. The French and the British high commands made no use of the extraordinary intelligence that had been communicated to them, always well in advance to turn events to their advantage. And on the other side, like I said, here was Hitler. He had them all. He had the whole expeditionary force of all the British, the military. He had them right there. All he had to do was move on them. the war would have been over right there, at least for a while. As a result, these high commands were in large parts responsible for the defeat of 1940. They cannot seek to it sounds like, you know, we have both sides making horrible mistakes here, and just one made more mistake than the other. They cannot seek to evade their share of the responsibility, nor will they ever be able to exculpate themselves fully from the accusations that can be leveled against them for their failures at that time. Largely through their fault, Europe fell under German occupation, and millions of human beings were sacrificed to the madness of the Nazis. At Lucerne, the collapse of the Allies due to great extent to the military high command's failure to believe in the secret struggles being waged in their support stupefied Roessler. Astonishment was followed by bitterness from his home at Wesselen, where his transmitter receiver was hidden. He alerted his friends. They were to stop sending documents and limit themselves to weekly interchanges. It was pointless for Werther and Olga to expose themselves to danger when no one took the slightest notice of their warnings. General Gazin, too, was now undergoing a certain amount of anxiety. Although the military leader of a neutral country, he, like Roessler, had been trying to help the Allies. Convinced of an early Allied victory, he had even been imprudent enough to, though with the assent of the Political Bureau of the Federal Consul, to sign a secret military convention well before the Wehrmacht had invaded Europe, with the General Maurice Garland of France, an agreement which might be used against the Confederation if it were ever to fall into the German hands. Gauzin and Gamelin had agreed that the Confederation could ask for the help of French troops and even allow them access to their territory if their strategic needs required it. Anxiety over the compromising agreement now prompted Gauzin to conceive of the necessity for a line of national defense. It was more than ever necessary to maintain the Berlin-Lucerne contact that Misson and Hausemann argued so highly of, which they were so proud. In the event of Hitler's deciding to invade Swiss territory, Gauzin would know about it sufficiently well in advance to organize his last desperate resistance. For the Swiss general had never underestimated the importance of the Secret Service. It might even be said that it formed one of the basic components of his strategy. Misson himself, or one of his assistants, attended every meeting of the high command, which was the case in remarkably few other countries. Now ignorant of the existence of the temporary interruption in activity between Roessler and the Bureau, H.A., Mason instructed Xavier Schneiper to ask his German friend to come to the Villa Stutz at once. Hausemann managed to find the right words for the occasion. Quote, "Switzerland is in danger," he told Roessler, "and the Nazis are drunk with victory, but the war is not yet over. A resistance movement has begun in Norway, and before long, similar movements will begin in France." On June 18th, General de Gaulle made an appeal from London. "Great Britain will not surrender. We must continue our work. It is your duty to do so. The Confederation opened its frontiers to you when misfortune struck our country. You, in turn, should help them in the trials that lie ahead." Only too happy to serve, Roessler immediately alerted his friends in Berlin they would not give up. The struggle would be begun again. Let's see here. What time is it? Well, we got a little more time. This is Chapter 5. From June 1940 onward, Roessler had been giving top priority to any intelligence received from Berlin that might be of value to Switzerland. In mid-July 1940, a tense situation existed on the western frontier between St. Louis, and General Masson's own agents had discovered 6 German divisions, 2 mountain troops, encamped near the border and ready to attack. They also mentioned border patrols, the laying of telephone cable, and the German espionage activity around Swiss installations in the area. "Were these preparations for a surprise attack?" Roessler asked Berlin. On July 18th, less than 24 hours after his request, he received a full reply. There was nothing to fear for the moment. The OKW was too preoccupied with the problems presented by a possible invasion of Britain, the Altieri plan, to give time to Switzerland. Reassured for the present and wishing to make full sense of Roessler's services, the Swiss now ask him whether, in addition to his present work, he would take on another job. They wanted him to sift and evaluate the massive intelligence they received. Most of the business of their secret service consisted simply of amassing data, but the data had to be then be interpreted, assigned to its relative importance, and fitted into a total synthesis. Roessler was perfectly suited to such a job. Moreover, his nationality and intellectual training rendered him particularly able to predict how a fellow German would react or tackle a particular problem. Roessler agreed. Nevertheless, he in no way neglected the mission he was carrying out for Werther and Olga. On August 3, 1940, Roessler relayed virtually important messages to the Swiss center at Lucerne. On July 31st, Hitler had informed his high command of his irrevocable decision to attack Russia. His statement on that occasion shows that his own plans of aggression had long been ready. Quote, "I am convinced that Britain's determination to continue the struggle is based upon the expected support of the USSR. Strange things are taking place on the other side of the channel. Yesterday, the British were faltering. Now they are on their feet once again. It is enough that Russia, anxious on account of our conquest in the West, should let it be understood that she would not view with favor any further development of German power. For the British to cling like drowning men to the hope of a complete reversal of the situation within a few months. If we crush Russia, Britain's last hope will fade with her, and Germany will become the mistress of Europe, including the Balkans. Russia must be liquidated. The attack will take place in the spring of 1941. We shall launch two offensives at once, one in the south, in the direction of Kiev, Ukraine. It's interesting how Ukraine keeps coming up in history. And the Dnieper, the other in the north, through the Baltic states towards Moscow. There, the two armies will link up. Then, if necessary, a special operation will be mounted to secure the Baku oil fields. 120 divisions will be allotted to this front. 60 will be enough in the west. The offensive will last 5 months and begin in March 1941. This information was a great consolation for the Swiss, for if war broke out between Germany and Russia, the Reich would have no troops left to invade the Confederation. But at the same time, the information was a source of embarrassment. Not knowing how to handle it, the Swiss were prepared to keep it to themselves. But one day, you will have to decide to communicate this news to the Russians, Roessler told Hazeman. You know very well that we are bound to receive more and more of this sort of intelligence. I must remember that my objective, and that of the men I represent, remains the death of Nazism. We are ready to help whoever will do most to achieve that, and whatever their nationality. The German and Russian are not at war yet, Major Hausmann said, and nothing indicates that the Russians have turned against Hitler and his Nazis. In any case, we shall never communicate with them. I am to understand that I shall be allowed to warn them. Hausmann was clever enough not to reply. From that August 1940, while continuing to supply the Swiss with intelligence on the movements of German troops within the Reich and analyzing it, Roessler was studying ways of warning the Russians. Time was running short. An avalanche of data pouring out of the OKW headquarters in Berlin revealed in ever greater detail the preparations for the invasion of the Soviet Union were proceeding steadily. See, they had all the information all the time, right up to date, fresh stuff. On December 5, 1940, Generals Halder and Brauchwitz submitted to the Führer the Otto Plan. The details of the attack worked out by the high command in Moscow. It suggests not an important objective. The Red Army would be pushed back into the Prepet marshes from the north and the south, there to be encircled and destroyed. Romania and Finland would share in the spoils, and the two attacks would be launched from these countries. They would also supply support troops for the Wehrmacht. At the head of the Finnish troops, General Eduard Dietl, mountain troops would advance on Petsamo in Lapland and occupy the Arctic ports. This division would have to be transferred from Narvik in Norway to Finland through Sweden, which had just agreed to this. Hitler accepted the Otto plan enthusiastically, putting some of the finished touches to it. He renamed it Operation Barbarossa and read it out to his generals on December 18, 1940. The preliminaries of the operation were to be completed by May 15, 1941. This perfect plan was to remain unaltered. To preserve the maximum possibility of secrecy, Hitler ordered that only 9 copies were made of it. One was distributed to each of the armed forces, the Wehrmacht, the Luftwaffe, and the Kriegsmarine. The other 6 were to remain at OKW headquarters. A week later, just after Christmas, Roessler received the longest message so far. In the 8 installments spread over a period of 48 hours and took 12 hours to decipher, it was a real bombshell, nothing less than a complete copy of Operation Barbarossa. Confronted with this document, Roessler was troubled, imagining the difficulties his friends must be encountering daily. Even if they were able to see important plans in the normal course of their work, it was also necessary to get hold of them secretly. They were obviously taking ever greater risks. He did not know what to do with the results. He had tried unsuccessfully to find a way of warning the Russians to the third party. There remained only one solution, one he had so far rejected because it would compel him to deal with the communists. His friend Christian Schneider, the man who had helped him assemble his transmitter receiver and taught him Morse code, Roessler knew Schneider's opinions only too well, having argued against them on an occasion of the signing of the German-Soviet Pact. He invited his fellow countrymen to lunch during the meal in a Lucerne restaurant under Der Egg on the banks of the Reuss. Not far from his office, he asked Schneider point blank, "Do you know how I could talk to the Russians? I have vital information, intelligence in my hands that could be of the greatest use to the Soviet Union. If they want to pay for it, they can do so later, as I shall have much more. I'm quite willing to collaborate, though I don't care for the word for nothing." Schneider pondered for a time. "If you don't make them pay you," he said at last, "they'll take you for an agent provocateur. I know them. Is it really important intelligence?" Roessler resolved to be frank. "The German intend to invade Russia." "Are you sure of your source?" Schneider asked incredulously. "Absolutely," and Roessler reminded him of the wireless set. He told Schneider he had friends in Germany who could hardly be better placed. Then he laid down his one condition. The Russians must never try to discover their identity. Schneider rose and murmured doubtfully. That would certainly be the most difficult thing for Moscow to accept. 2 weeks later, Schneider called the Vita Nova Verlag in Lucerne. The anonymity cause had not helped matters. The Russians still knew nothing about the matter, but in Geneva there was a Soviet intelligence cell for which Schneider worked. Well, I think that's enough for today. It's getting more exciting, at least to me. I hope it is for you, and we'll continue. What is today? Saturday. We'll continue next week with some more reading from The Man Called Lucy. See, guys like this are worth more than many divisions as far as the military is concerned, and it applies to politics and everything else. If you're going to spend money on any kind of resistance to obsessive and dangerous system, you got to have intelligence. And that's what's more important at this time than anything else. and that is to keep an eye on what they're doing, what they're saying, and what you think they're going to do, and all that kind of stuff. Even if you can't use it for any particular reason, to become like, it's like a muscle. You've got to keep exercising to get it bigger. So in the future, if something comes up that you need to use that muscle, you will have gotten into the situation years before. That's something I could never get across to the right wing. They act like it's, I don't know, sort of a B-movie and nothing's going to happen. But if you're involved in politics like this, this kind of politics, you've got to expect or believe that something really bad is going to happen, and you got to be ready for it. And the more serious I talked about that with the right wing, the less attention I got. So I'm sort of put off on the side as that old Bolshevik up there in Warsaw, Indiana, by the right wing, by Dr. Pierce. 14:5. This is a little longer show. A little longer show. I hope you're set up. I hope you've got Google or Yahoo.